let's welcome Huntsman Spider. What a warm welcome. In fact, it's so warm that you allow me to
It's very un-German to do that, but I do.
Well, first, I really want to thank the Islamic Center here in Milwaukee to have given its premises to make such an evening possible. And I also want to thank Peace Action. There are so many groups in this country that are saying and thinking what I think and say, and you heard just now enormous eloquence down here. I don't need to go to Washington. He can go to Washington. You know. But it is such a complex story. And every time I speak about Iraq, I afterwards ask myself, have I really been fair? Have I done the justice to explain to people who didn't have the experience that I have had? And I'm not so sure. But I pledge one thing to you, and that is, I will be as honest as I can. What do I have to hide? Why I have to hide anything? I'm not in the employment of anybody. Except I carry with me every day what all of us have, and that is a conscience. And when you have a conscience, then it's very hard to try and deceive. And I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do a favor to Majid, whom he talked about. Majid, little boy or little girl in Iraq, deserve all the honesty that people like I, who have lived there, who have seen, and what Arundhati Roy, the famous Indian writer, says, what you have seen, you cannot unsee. It stays with you. And therefore, I have the courage to speak out on a subject which, I must tell you, has earned me a lot of humiliation, has earned punches. I'm not received in the area in the offices where I used to be received. I try to go to the British Foreign Office, I find the shut door. Probably I will find the shut door in Washington in the State Department as well. Why? We must talk about that tonight. As Jeremy said, tomorrow is an important day. The 31st of July is that day when something takes place that must take place when it is a question of deciding on war or on peace. And what I had hoped was that the Senate of a country that is today the world's leader would quite naturally insist, in order also to protect its own professionalism and integrity, on ensuring that there will be a panel that is balanced, that hears the full range of issues on this immensely complex issue of Iraq. And yet, when you see the list, as I have, and I've studied it, then I think you come to the same conclusion to which Jeremy came, and that is, it is a who is who of those who have decided that the only answer in dealing with Iraq is the military answer. We have a director of Desert Storm in that team. We have a defector, a nuclear scientist from Iraq. I think it would be impossible to believe that a person who has left this country can be totally objective in talking about that country. There's deep pain in the heart of Iraqi Americans, and what they think is, here is a dictator. Yes, there is a dictator. And who was a dictator? But I don't think that is enough to answer the question whether or not there should be a war against this country. There is an advocate, a professor, a full professor testifying tomorrow, whom Amnesty International has admonished for having advocated excessive force against Palestinians in the Middle East. We have an advocate who has never said anything, but before we do talk about anything else, Saddam Hussein must be removed. We have a gentleman whom the Los Angeles Times defines as a self-hating Arab. No Arab intellectual has made himself so cordially disliked by his peers, is a statement in the Los Angeles Times. There's someone else who tries to argue that there is a black and white picture, that it is all the fault of one man that explains the plight of the Iraqi people and nothing else comes. That's the issue. We have another one who will testify tomorrow, who feels that he has the right to say that Iraq has started again the production of weapons of mass destruction. So we have here an opportunity for one of the most important committees of the U.S. means of the U.S. Congress, and that is to have to opt for having an objective assessment, or to consolidate tomorrow this increasingly tall wall of disinformation to make the case about something which you had long ago already decided. And that is frightening in my view. I want to tell you how something like that can actually look like. If you look at the statements that come out of the U.S. government, you will see, for example, that Mr. Wolfowitz in Istanbul recently said, every day that passes makes Iraq more dangerous. Well, that's a statement. I would like, and I'm sure you would like, to know why that is so. And then you go like this. You go through the press, and you try to get statements that confirm that there is an enormous amount of disinformation in relationship to that which I happen to know. And I'll tell you, I'm not clear now, but I will be very clear in a minute. I read in the, for example, in the Sunday Times, British Sunday Times, Saddam Hussein is rebuilding a plant that was used to make biological weapons during the Gulf War under the cover of tackling foot and mouth disease. I read about that same plant. UN inspectors destroyed this German warfare equipment, but large parts of the facility were left intact. Recently, it says, it was allowed to resume its role as a testing and diagnostic center for foot and mouth. I won't quote much more, but to make my point, I would like to say, the New York Times recently wrote, Al-Fallujah, it's another facility outside of Baghdad, is currently involved in chemical weapons production. And it continues and says, nevertheless, the factories in Fallujah, whose reconstruction has been detected in satellite photographs, have raised alarms, State Department officials said. Now comes my point. 2 weeks ago, I was in Iraq. I took with me a team from the German television. I went to Al-Zora. The government of Iraq allowed me to do that, to this facility that at one point produced foot and mouth disease and was allegedly restarting, as I just quoted. I went to Al-Fallujah in the western desert, where allegedly castor oil residue was converted again into chemical warfare agents. And what did I see? I saw the foot and mouth disease vaccine plant in exactly the same destroyed condition in which I saw it in 1999. There was not one piece that had been moved. It was a totally disabled, empty shell where UN arms inspectors had simply dismantled the whole operation. There was no human being even there. In this other facility, I mean, it was almost unbelievable. Instead of seeing something dangerous, I saw pigeons flying in the warehouses that we inspected, and we went to all the buildings. It wasn't that we were selectively shown something. So here you have a statement: Iraq is becoming dangerous by the day. You have newspaper articles that try to suggest that you even have satellite photographs that confirm that Iraq is doing something. And then an innocent man who is not an arms expert, but who has eyes and ears, goes with a television team there and photographs it all to show that these two facilities are totally defunct and destroyed. Now, I think on that basis, I can argue without any immodesty, ladies and gentlemen, that my evidence is better than Donald Rumsfeld's. It is remarkable, if not frightening, to see how since, and please understand, I'm not doing US bashing here. I'm not doing even a government bashing. I just want to put before you a case as I've seen it. It is amazing that since January of 2001, we see a very systematic effort to escalate the rhetoric to show that Iraq is an immense danger to not only its neighbors, but also to a country like the United States. And since the 11th of September, of course, things have moved faster to show that it is. You will agree with me if you have followed the news that there were many attempts to link Iraq with the 11th of September, with the World Trade Center attack in 1993, with the bombing of your embassies in Dar es Salaam and in Nairobi, with the attack on your USS Cole in Aden. Even I've seen, maybe you also, Oklahoma bomber was linked to Iraq. So all that fell like a house of cards. There was no evidence. Then came the next level, trying to implicate Iraq being linked to Al-Qaeda. This very strange story about Mohammed Atta meeting in Prague with a member of the Iraqi intelligence. Maybe it happened. Maybe. Let's assume it happened. Is that enough justification to destroy a country, to declare war against Iraq? I don't think so. Now there is a group that I saw 2 weeks ago. I went across the line of control in northern Iraq. You have 3 Kurdish provinces. They are under local autonomy. Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, has no influence in that area. In that area of Kurdish territory is a small fundamentalist group of 400 to 600, according to the Kurds living, political figures living there, of 400 to 600 fundamentalists who are creating a tremendous nuisance in that area for one of the 2 Kurdish factions. I asked, what kind of group is there? Is it true that they are having a link to Al-Qaeda? And the answer was, yes, there is a link to Al-Qaeda because some of the members of Al-Qaeda escaped from Afghanistan and joined this small group of fundamentalists. I asked the Kurds who would be the first to suggest that there could be a link to Saddam Hussein, to Baghdad. Are there any links between these fundamentalists plus a sprinkle of Al-Qaeda people? And the answer was, we don't think so. But in the press, there's now a case made that Baghdad is cooperating with Al-Qaeda. So it's another level of distortion. It also seems now to collapse. Then, when this somehow wasn't so convincing, the net was cast wider trying to implicate Iraq and make the case for war, and that is the axis of evil argument. All countries that are sympathetic to terrorism are on our list, and Iraq, of course, is without question, sympathetic to terrorism, there's no evidence, but this is the way the argument goes. That, again, didn't gel that much with the public and with other governments. And then came the latest that I've seen about 2 weeks ago, a statement by Mr. Rumsfeld, who said, technology and terrorism are a lethal combination and we will try to destroy it. What he meant was the technology was in Iraq and terrorism was somewhere else, and therefore one had to right to try and do something. So there's a groping, you will admit, there's a groping for evidence to try to implicate Iraq. And all of that, as I've tried to show you, is falling like a house of cards. Now you can ask me, as I've been asked before, why is that so? Why is there this attempt to do all that? I think I have two answers to give. One is, in October 1998, the US Congress passed something which is called the Iraq Liberation Act. And if you read that document, you see two references that it is the declared objective of the US Congress to obtain by force a regime change. Very, 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 very sensitive thing, because you won't have many supporters of that kind of approach in trying to solve a political conflict. So, the new administration, the Republican administration, seems to take that. George, thank you very much. Thank you. Seems to take that Iraq Liberation Act much more serious than the previous administration. That's one reason. The other reason is the political landscape in the Middle East is changing dramatically and quickly. And in the last year, we have seen immense changes which cannot be hidden. There is no homogeneous support for a US policy of confrontation anymore in the Middle East. We've had the getting together of the heads of Arab governments in the Arab League in Beirut in March. They came together, they met. Of course there were disagreements, but important is what came out of that summit. A statement which, among other things, said, we are against wars in the Middle East, and then, more specifically, we do not want to see our brotherly country, Iraq, attacked. Now, this was said by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia also, not just by others who were more moderate participants in the political discussion. That was a clear message to us, to Europeans, to Asians, to Africans, to Americans, to realize that there is a peace process in the making, and we, in Europe, in North America, should respect it. Secretary General of the Arab League went on a tour. He went to Kuwait, he went to Iraq, he tried to mend fences. King Abdullah of Jordan has tried to do the same. So, normalization of Iraqi relations with their neighbors is in full swing. Iraq today has diplomatic relations with every Arab country except Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And even with Saudi Arabia, there is now a much improved situation. They have reopened their border. Businessmen in Baghdad are selling, Saudi Arabian businessmen are selling their goods. There was a Saudi fair, an industrial fair in Baghdad recently. When I was in Baghdad, I saw a Saudi businessman in my hotel. With Syria is a full rehabilitation of previously very complicated relationships with President Assad. The sun has done it very quickly differently. With Iran and Iraq, these days are exchanging prisoners of war, are exchanging the remains of people who died in this horrible war between Iran and Iraq. Even with Kuwait is an improved situation. Iraq has agreed to return what is perceived as a national treasure in Kuwait, the National Archives. So there is a good basis to build a new relationship in the Middle East through non-military means. And I think this is making this whole attempt of fighting it out, of finishing the chapter by military means, much more controversial. And I think the U.S. government also is realizing that the presence of the U.S. military in the Middle East is on notice. Have you seen the situation in Saudi Arabia? The public is opposed to a continued presence of foreign soldiers on that territory. As a result, what was meant to become the command center in a war against Iraq by the U.S., the Sultan Air Base near Riyadh, is being shifted into the neighboring country that is politically much weaker to resist U.S. pressure, and that is Qatar. As a result of the intentions to have a confrontation of this kind, a conflict has broken out in Jordan involving the future of the monarchy. King Abdullah only yesterday, I think it was, said in London, the only person who is getting it in the U.S. administration is Colin Powell. The others don't get us. They don't hear us that we don't want this. Crown Prince Abdullah, who was hoping to be the king of Jordan, has joined and given his sympathies to the Iraqi opposition, so there is an open conflict. All this is recognized by the administration, and there's a sense of authority. We have to do it now. If we don't do it now, maybe our troops will be asked to leave the Gulf and mission not accomplished. So this propels, I think, the wish to hit Iraq at all costs as soon as possible. And I think the U.S. and tomorrow's hearings should realize that there is an incredible, to me as an outsider, I am just stunned when I see groups like yours, when I read papers, when I talk to people on the street, when I read articles of the community press, not just what is easily sort of cast aside as the left wing. It's not just the left wing. I think it's the good citizenry, the citizenry with a sense of justice, with a sense of what is honest and what one should do rather than what one shouldn't do. And there is that disconnect, that unbelievable disconnect between you, these groups. That's not demagogy. I'm not a populist. That's just my distinct impression from quite a few travels through the U.S. where I see these groups that want to set it right, want to do it right, want to make sure that the global community understands that there is another America and the political decision-making in Washington. That's unbelievable. I mean, sometimes people may think that I'm flattering you. I'm not flattering you when I say you are 10 times better organized than we are in Europe. 10 times. You are speaking among yourselves, you have organizations. We heard tonight about the alliance that you have here in Milwaukee. You talk to your representatives. And despite all that, there is this disconnect between what you are saying, what you are thinking, and what is being decided in Washington. I can't really understand why this is so, but when it is a question of peace or war, I think this disconnect, it must become a connect. That's the case. Now let me just try to answer the question a little bit more. Why is there this whole presence? And why is there now this mood to attack? Well, I gave a hint already by saying, in a way, the U.S. is on notice in their presence in the Middle East. But at a higher level of abstraction and importance also, is something quite different. And that is, I think, in one slightly provocative sentence, I think one I can express by quoting Henry Kissinger what I mean here. It was Henry Kissinger who said quite a few years ago, oil is much too important a commodity to be left in the hands of the Arabs. I think it's oil, it's energy, and we should be very, very concerned that in all these years we have done such a miserable progress in finding non-conventional sources of energy that would free us from that kind of dependency. And instead, oil remains the basis for our factories, for our Western life, for our good life, our life that is so much better than the life of many of the countries that produce the oil that we buy from them. So it is maybe that may be the real issue, retaining a handle on the sources of energy that is needed in the industrialized world. Now, while all of this is going on, all this positioning, all this threatening, don't you think that even in a close dictatorship like the one in Iraq, that the people don't have feelings, that they don't realize what we are doing there, that we are now talking and preparing to attack them? And what does that to their psyche? What does that to the mental state of health of the adults? And what do sanctions do to the mental state of health of the young, of the youth, and of the entire situation? That was, ladies and gentlemen, what really got me into trouble. I don't regret one minute that I got into trouble for having spoken out fairly early. And I remember very well, I had this fateful lunch in my office. It wasn't meant to take place, but it took place because a journalist from the New York Times came an hour later than I expected him. He came at 12. I said, well, now it is 12, you have eaten, I have eaten, let us share a lunch. So what was meant to be a short interview became a lengthy interview. And out of that came an article, a dispatch from Baghdad to New York. Headline was, Senior UN Official Calls for the Lifting of Sanctions. And in that article, I had made the point that the Iraq government, the US government, and the British government were playing a political battle on the back of innocent people. And that was the beginning of my clarity within myself that I could definitely not be associated with such an approach. That was in October 1999. That was in October 1999, and I resigned in February of 2000, so a few months later. I had to show my cards. I simply couldn't continue. Now, in making the case of the punishment that is inflicted by sanctions on the people, please do understand that I am not for one minute overlooking what the repression by Saddam Hussein has done to the people in Iraq. I mean, the Iraq coin, like any other coin, has two sides. And Iraqi people are getting a double punishment, in a way. They're getting it from within, and they're getting it from outside. But the point is that for many years, the overwhelming weight of punishment is from outside our sanctions. 12 long years. In the year 2000, the British House of Commons, in a report on Iraq, came to the conclusion that there had never been before more severe, comprehensive economic sanctions against any country than against Iraq. And they expressed the hope that this should never be repeated. This was in the country that is an ally in the forthcoming, or hopefully not forthcoming, war against Iraq. And what has happened? Unfortunately, neither Jeremy nor anyone here in this room, nor I, who have been in Iraq, can describe correctly and fully the magnitude of the suffering that is taking place in that country. It's not possible, because it's unimaginable. I grew up as a little boy in a country that had also a dictator. We suffered a lot, and we were helped by you. And when that Second World War was over, you gave us Marshall Plan A. When Operation Desert Storm was over, when the Gulf War was over, Iraq got sanctions. So the people start already with a very tremendous disadvantage in Iraq in 1991. And what we can say today is it's a nation that is destroyed. You have in this country, I hope it's still possible, every month when Iraqi Americans are putting a bag full of cash together and they're traveling to Iraq to help a little bit, here and there. I know Iraqi Americans, Iraqi British, who support schools, who support their families, who help to carry out operations and to bridge punishment. That isn't just a punishment against a whole nation, but it's cruel, the punishment at the individual level. I know of a case of a man who needed a heart surgery in Amman from Iraq, an Iraqi. He had a bank account in London. The British Central Bank did not allow him to draw on that money to have this operation, even though it was his own money. In the end, it became possible by making the central bank agree to pay the bills directly. No money in the hands or the pocket of an individual Iraqi, even if it was his own money. So today we have, according to UNICEF statistics, we have an apparent 55% of the entire 23 million people living below the poverty line, not being able to support themselves properly. And if you add to that the monthly food basket that is handed each month to a family or to individuals, if they had to buy that food basket by themselves rather than accepting it as a free item from the government of Iraq, paid out of Iraqi oil money, then over 90% of the population will be below the poverty line. So it's a very grim and dismal and unbelievable picture. Let me give you a few more examples to show that picture more. The World Health Organization has shown that children between 0, not yet 1 year, and 6 years of age, that there is suddenly a tremendous increase in mental disorder. In 1990, the World Health Organization argued that 200,000 children were mentally not healthy. That was at the beginning of the of the invasion into Iraq. And now, 12 years later, not quite 12 years, I'm sorry, 8 years later, the figure goes back to 1998, it had risen to over 500,000. These are young, from 0 to 6 years of age, who already are mentally, for all kinds of reasons. You can imagine if the unemployment is between 60% and 75%. You can imagine these are not healthy households. You can believe me when I say that the parents don't have the energy, the patience, the interest even in creating the kind of family atmosphere that would make a child grow in a good way. So that may explain something. Average salaries in Iraq between $3 and $6. A retired army general gets $15, but a school teacher gets $3-$4. A university professor, I know quite a few, but one that I always refer to make the point, trained in the United States with a PhD in home economics. She, after over 35 years of service, starting when she was a young lecturer back home in Iraq, She started with a salary around $400. Today she is getting 19,000 dinars, which is about a little bit more now than $10. That's what she's earning in, and then it is not surprising when you go into a house at random. I did that in Basra, I did it in Baghdad during my last trip. We were filming the distribution of food. And here was, there were about 20 people in front of one of these distribution centers. I looked around and I saw an impressive elderly man, and I approached him. I said, can I do something that I don't easily do? I would like to ask you to allow me to visit your house. And I asked him that after he had told me that under sanctions he had no choice but to sell his personal belongings, his TV, a refrigerator. Now, in Basra, when I was there, you may think I'm exaggerating, but Jeremy can confirm it, 134 degrees. And then you live in a modern building and you have no refrigerator. What this does to the food, you can imagine. So he told me all that, and then I asked him, I said, can I come? He said, come, have a cup of tea. And I came, and television came with me, and we documented an empty house, a poor house. And he had been a director in government who in the meantime had retired. I could give you many, many other examples, but I don't want to give you too many to not overload you. But I must tell you that today children are dying in Iraq at a very high rate. Is it still 5,000 per month? No. According to UNICEF in a report published in 1999, I'm not sure. But does it really matter whether it is 4,800 or 5,300? I would say as a human being, one child that dies as a result of sanctions is one child too many. And why do they die? In the summer, they're dying because of diarrheal infections. Simple to treat. No problem. Before the century started, the same dictator, that same despicable man whom we really don't want, invested $450 million into his health budget for Iraq. Now, this year, when I went back, I just checked with my colleagues, the health budget is $20 million. $450 million in 1 year in 1989, $20 million in the year 2001, fiscal year 2002. I don't think one can expect from such a budget any more than what we see as far as the health condition is concerned. Then comes a subject which always moves me more than anything else, and that is the education budget. Because here we have an example that right now sanctions are sowing the seeds for disabling the next political generation in Iraq. No chairs, dilapidated buildings, no water, no transport, no school feeding, and something more. Iraq in 1987 got a prize, 87, an international prize from UNESCO. Why? Because it had brought down female illiteracy to 20%. Now, female illiteracy is again 48%. I did some filming a year and a half ago with Swiss television in one school. It came out beautifully. The drama, the unreported drama, tomorrow in that hearing in Washington, no one will know about it and no one will talk about it. In that school, in 1998, there were 250 students. This was a primary school. 50 were girls. In talked about tonight, 20 were girls. In the year we did the filming in 2000, there were 8 girls back. So, the first victim are the young, and within the group of young, the prime victims are the girls. And is that setting the stage to build the kind of Iraq that we want to have? I don't think so. And if you think that when one is worried about weapons of mass destruction, that one is trying to do everything in the UN Security Council to block those items that are related to the manufacturing of weapons of mass destruction, only you're very wrong. Educational materials. Right now, out of the $5 billion that are held back in terms of already ordered humanitarian supplies, every sector that is included in the Oil for Food program is part of that. From agriculture, to electricity, to water, to sanitation, to food, to medicines, and even education. 68 million textbooks are right now required that are not available. Teaching aids, you can go into any low-income school in the Milwaukee area and you will have a 10, 20 times better situation, I guarantee you, than you find in the best school in Iraq. And to make it even to add insult to injury, there's a U.S. Postal Administration, a U.S. Postal Regulation, which forbids printed matter to be sent to Iraq. If you want to send to a friend in Iraq sheets of music, it will be returned. You cannot do that. You're violating a U.S. Postal Regulation. So as someone not long ago said to me in Mosul, in northern Iraq, he said, they have ruined us economically. Now, they also show evidence that they are ruining or want to ruin our minds. And I think it's not too far-fetched when one gives evidence of this kind. I have lots more to say, but I don't want to talk too much. Maybe you have questions later. But I do want to bear with me a little bit longer. And maybe the younger ones, if they really get fed up with me, head up, and I will try to collapse a few of the things that I want to say. But I must tell you something. I must tell you that from whatever angle you look at the political treatment of Iraq, you will find punishment is aborted. Whether it is the way resolutions are formulated, whether it is the way procedures are introduced that have nothing to do with normal procedures in United Nations business. For example, when I will go to New York to brief the Security Council on Iraq, we would have ample opportunity outside the hall to talk to Iraqi diplomats. But when the actual briefing on Iraq started, no Iraqi diplomat was allowed to come into the hall to listen to what I have to say about Iraq. Is this what the United Nations that you created, that we created, is meant for? A house where people cannot exchange, where people cannot try to solve their conflicts around the table, where you exclude people who have something to do with the very issue that you are discussing in the conference room? It was shocking. Punishment. Trying to disable. Have you, I mentioned that in medicine also, when you hopefully never will have a car accident and you take the car to a repair facility and the repair facility says to you, yeah, we can repair that, but it will cost you $800. And your insurance company says, well, you have a $200 deductible, so we will pay you back $600, then you will accept that. What about the UN Compensation Commission that has been established in Geneva, where I live at the moment, which gets out of every Iraqi oil dollar 25 cents, a quarter of the income that Iraq earns goes into that Compensation Commission. For what? To pay firms, governments, and individuals who feel that they have been victimized in the invasion of Iraq into Kuwait. Now, if they get a request for compensation, and now I come back to this parallel with the insurance company, and the party that wants compensation says, I want $111 million in compensation. And then comes 3 months later, the decision by the UN Compensation Commission, not 111, insurance company will pay you 80%. No, they say not 111, you're getting 170 billion. So they're getting much more than what they're asking for. And it's not an isolated case. It's not their money. It's Iraqi money. The difference between $111 million and $170 million could fantastically well go into education, could go into the purchase of medicines, could go into better quality food. No, it's punishment. And I think this is what makes one angry. And I could expand to you, I could go into international legal details that would go too far, but I could show you in very, very clear terms that the United Nations Charter is misused, is arbitrarily applied. And I am not anti-American when I say it is the U.S. government that keeps making this their focus, their attempt to keep the lid on the whole discussion by arbitrarily applying the tools that are there to solve an issue. And then come under pressure. And here I want to say the glass of water. This glass of water consists of many drops. What we do individually are drops, but together they make a glass of water. And I think that over the years, these many glasses of water, of people's pressures, have had an impact, have led to improvements. The Security Council has challenged repeatedly the American insistence that the status quo must prevail. And what started, will you believe this, what started as an oil for food program in 1996 with a per capita allocation of $130 per person per year to finance everything that I mentioned, from food to medicine, education, everything that that nation, any nation, needs, was raised gradually to higher amounts because it was so totally inadequate. And I also think that it was a mistake initially. Now it's a crime to link economic sanctions with military sanctions by arguing that if we have economic pressure, then they will disarm. That didn't happen. Or when we introduce economic pressure, political change will occur. Saddam Hussein will disappear. Did not happen. So if that doesn't happen, and year after year, you continue to do the same thing, are you surprised that international lawyers today accuse the United Nations Security Council of being genocidal, of violating just about every international law that exists, from the Convention on the Rights of the Child to the Covenant on Cultural, Economic and Social Rights? So there is an enormous pressure to which I think groups like you have contributed. And that led in May of this year to the introduction of so-called smart sanctions. Nothing smart about it. And in any case, as someone with a sense of humor, it's difficult to have a sense of humor in this discussion, said, if they introduce in May 2002 smart sanctions, what have been the sanctions the previous 10 years? So, one could say, and this is, I'm coming to the end really now, to what I try to explain, and that is, what should a government in Washington do? Here's a dictator. Here's a man who invaded another country. Here's a man who has gassed his own people in 1988. By the way, in 1988, neither the U.S. government nor my government severed diplomatic relations. We kept our masters there. Saddam Hussein was our front man against Iran. So we kept our mouth shut, almost. So, there's a lot of understanding that we should try and do something about this kind of a regime. But there are ways of doing that. And this, the war clouds that are gathered now in Washington, which no one else wants to see, neither the Middle East, as I tried to explain, nor in Europe, nor elsewhere. What are the alternatives? I would say there's a key word in my life that I would like to mention here, and that's dialogue. The United Nations, weak as it is, unfortunately, to a large extent, because of your government, is the UN is weak. I'm sorry to say that. But the UN exists, and as somebody said, if the UN wouldn't exist, we would have to invent it. And I think I share that view. So there is an alternative to military confrontation. I do not share one moment the perception of those like James Rubin, the former spokesman to Margaret Albright in the State Department, who comes up with a whole series of options, all of which are the military nature. There is an alternative. There is a different approach. And I would say a dialogue at three levels, very quickly, let me say. The dialogue at the UN Security Council, the dialogue in the Middle East, I refer to you the peace process that in a way is underway already among Arab countries. And a dialogue within Iran also. The Kurds are there, the Kurds know that they will never have the US as a neighbor. They will always have Baghdad as a neighbor. So they want a reconciliation of sorts with conditions, and lots of conditions, with a very difficult dialogue that will ultimately, hopefully, lead to a conclusion that the future, the good future, of Kurds, Shias, and Sunnis in Iraq lies in cooperation rather than confrontation. But they are talking to each other. That's the thing. That must be recognized. And the Washington Agreement tries to boycott this. They don't want to see the Kurds talk to Baghdad. And all of that is so unfortunate when there are at least three levels, when there is a preparedness to talk and to mend fences. And I know in Europe there are often people of Iraqi background will say, no, we don't want to talk until this ruthless man is gone. And I say, if you can isolate this ruthless man through a dialogue around the conference table, isn't that better than endangering the lives of relatives and friends and Iraqis through another war? Well, I think I better stop here. I hope that tomorrow evening, when we don't see each other anymore, we will not see what I feel right now, that is, the newspapers full with information that the Bush administration would be encouraged to attack Iraq rather than do what we all in this room, I'm sure, want, and that is a peaceful resolution. I want to end my presentation to you with a quote from someone whom I immensely respect, and that's Eleanor Roosevelt. She said, long, long, long ago, when will our conscience grow so tender that we will seek to prevent suffering rather than a vengeance?